From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller with stories of how women rise up. Every year, I make an actual printed photo album of my family's activities and vacation time. The cover of our 2016 album features me, my husband, and my two daughters looking super goofy and without a care in the world, in wetsuits, of all things. The photo album for 2017 is a little different. This one features my then 11-year-old daughter and three of her friends holding handmade protest signs they've created for the Women's March. You know, right after the 2016 election and what became the largest protest we've ever had in U.S. history. So that day, we got together on my deck to paint and glitter and build our mantles. In the photo, one of the boys is holding a sign he made that says, "To be a real man is to believe in women's rights." Another from one of the girls, "This is my future. Women's rights are human rights." And a third, younger girl displays, "Kindness is everything." These are not a bunch of angry women feminists, although some angry women feminists might have coached them a little bit on what to say. These are a bunch of kids who can see that the future is, literally, in their hands, and who spent a day making art to carry on a stick. The glitter is still on my deck. Making those signs, those works of art, really, was actually fun in the face of what we felt was a shocking turn of events. And we were not alone.
We have seen a narrative shift. We have seen a culture shift. We are in the middle of a cultural revolution. And how did that happen? I firmly believe that that happened with a lot of things coming together, but art was at the center of that. Storytelling was at the center of that. Sharing our stories, whether it was online, whether it was on videos, whether it was writing stories, whether it was writing poetry, whether it was making art, visual art has been incredible this past year, whether it was incredible music, artists were at the forefront of that cultural movement. And so now we're seeing that cultural shift.
That's Paola Mendoza, the artistic director of the Women's March. She curated the speakers and the musical performances with Jenny Suss. She led on partnerships, organized all of the artists, the visual direction of the march, and all the artwork and storytelling. As a first-generation immigrant, a Colombian American, and a woman of color, representation is near and dear to her heart. So you better believe she was intentional about including underrepresented voices and women of color.
What is important about that story is that what makes the United States beautiful, empowering, and why it holds so much hope is that an immigrant that was fatherless, homeless, and abandoned is still able to stand up against the president of the United States in the most historic, powerful way possible.
Besides arranging the diverse and powerful lineup of speakers and performers, ranging from America Ferrera to Gloria Steinem to Ilyasa Shabazz, Malcolm X's daughter, Paola also co-founded the Resistance Revival Chorus with Sarah Sophie Flicker to bring more joy into the movement by bringing back old songs and creating new ones. Sarah Sophie, along with co-founding the Resistance Revival Chorus, was also a national organizer and strategic advisor for the Women's March. And she's the founder of Citizens Band Political Cabaret and an aerialist. I know, these women do a lot.
What Paola and I really try to focus on is how do we change hearts and minds? Because we know that this administration is not going to do it for us.
Sarah Sophie's background is dramatically different from Paola's. Have you heard the story of Torvald Stauning?
And when the Nazis invaded Denmark, the story goes that it was my great-grandfather's idea for the king to wear a star and to tell the police force to wear a Jewish star. And then what ended up happening is most of the population put on a Jewish star, and it was impossible for the Nazis to tell who was who.
Okay, so together, Paola and Sarah Sophie brought in all these artists to create artwork for the Women's March, created the Why I March videos, and in celebration of the one-year anniversary of the Women's March, they've published a book called Together We Rise. And it documents the scenes behind the Women's March, from before, during, and after, to the question of, now what? And it's out right now. We got together while I was in New York recently to talk about the power of art and culture in activism. Paola and Sarah Sophie, like many of us, think of their lives as before and after the election of Donald Trump. Here's what Paola told me.
Before Donald Trump was elected, I was a writer, director, a filmmaker, working in narrative films as well as documentary, and most of my films dealt with immigration, undocumented, specifically immigration. Post-Donald Trump, since the world exploded after Donald Trump, personally anyways, I started working and volunteering at the Women's March. So I was a national organizer for the Women's March and the artistic director of the Women's March. And in the year since the Women's March has happened, I've continued to work there, continued to do art, cultural activism stuff, as well as some films, but not so much anymore.
And Sarah Sophie.
Before the election, for a while now, I've been working in the cultural political space and sort of merging the two. So that's everything from a political theater group called the Citizens Band that I'm the creative director of and I do trapeze with. And I worked previously with Art Not War, making, you know, cultural campaigns for organizations like Emily's List. We worked sort of tangentially with the Clinton campaign and things of that nature. And since, I'd say, you know, 5 days after the election, I have been a national organizer at the Women's March. And the great love story of the Women's March is that Paola and I found each other, and now we get to make all this incredible work together.
So, Sarah Sophie, I need to hear about how you became a trapeze artist.
I don't think I've heard this story. Our affair has not included this story.
Oh,
Sarah
it's
Sophie.
Not that interesting, I don't think.
And why you keep doing it, because I don't know, the idea of being...
Oh, I have a good story about that. So I just was a pretty serious dancer until I was around 15, and then I just wanted to find a way to segue, you know, the dance that my body knows into something that I could perform. And I met this incredible woman, Chelsea Bacon, who is a historically amazing trapeze aerialist. And she just started teaching me. And then we started the Citizens Band together like 6 months later. So I've been performing not that well since, you know, the beginning of my aerial career. So I guess maybe like 3 or 4 months after the election, like a month or so after the Women's March, my husband was walking down the street with our 7-year-old and they saw some circus thing. And my 7-year-old said, "Oh, mommy would have loved that if Hillary Clinton had won the election." And my husband told me that and I was like, damn, I'm not going to let these motherfuckers steal my joy. Mm-hmm. And I was so grateful that he had that, my 7-year-old had that insight. Because then I ended up performing and, you know, there's the part of this we can't normalize. And, like, I want to talk about that because it's so important. But also, like, you have to keep your life normal.
Well, Paola, I'd love to hear what your immigration story is. I mean, I know that it's been part of what drives you. You just said that. So tell us how that
so
worked for you.
I'm from Colombia. I was born in Colombia. My mom was very young when she had me. She had me at 22, and she had my brother when she was 18. And so she immigrated to the United States with my father, who had come a few months earlier. And so we immigrated to Los Angeles. So we were the only Colombians in LA. No one. Yeah, the only ones. They were like, "Oh, what are you?" And so we came to the United States, to Los Angeles. We had no family here. My mom didn't speak English. She barely had a high school education. And then after a few months of being in the United States, my father abandoned us. So he left my mom at the age of 24 with a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, no English, no family, no education, and with like $200 in her pocket. And so my mom made miracles happen every day. She made the impossible happen every day. And we went through being homeless. We went through living, being on welfare. We went through living in the projects. But through that, all of that, she was able to get an education herself. She went to community college. She worked at a fast food restaurant. And she says that she learned English from an Italian woman that didn't speak English. So to this day, my mom's English is cute, but not the best.
With an Italian accent.
Exactly. And so she put two kids through college. We both have our master's degrees. She, you know, we have our own families. We each own houses. Like, we, in many ways, are the epitome of the American dream. And that is the thing that we all need to fight for, no matter what aisle or how, what is your belief system. That is the thing that we need to fight for.
So what made you want to become a filmmaker?
You know, my road to being an artist is a very different road. As immigrant children, there is a lot of responsibility to make sure that your parents' sacrifices live up to the life that you're living. So that translates to being a doctor, being a lawyer, being a teacher, being something that is like very stable. So when I decided that I wanted to be an artist, my mom hit the fan. She was like, what the fuck are you talking about? She didn't talk to me for like 3 weeks. She was like, you can't do that. You're going to starve. I didn't come to this country for you to starve. No, 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 no. And I finally sat down and I told my mom, I was like, Mom, this is what I want to do. And the reason why I want to do it is because I found my voice. Like, I found a way in which I can express myself. This is who I am. And you can either support me or you cannot. But this is what I'm going to do. Since then, my mom has become my biggest fan. She loves everything that I do. But that responsibility, from feeling the responsibility of needing to be a lawyer, a doctor, or some sort of professional, has shifted to what are the types of stories that I'm telling, right? That's my responsibility. And so my responsibility as an artist, as a filmmaker, and even as an activist now, is to shine a light on women in particular whose stories we don't often hear, who we walk by on the street and we ignore them. And to me, those women are the women that I grew up with, and they're the unsung heroes of America. They're the they are the fabric of America, the dishwashers, the janitors, the caregivers, the caretakers. And so that now, and has been my goal as a filmmaker, is to tell those stories with love, tell those stories with dignity, because so often those stories are told in salacious and untruthful ways, and tell those stories honestly, so that those stories can be the bridge to other Americans and other people around the world.
Okay, Sarah Sophie. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear a bit more about your background and what led you to being interested in women's issues and women's rights, and how art has played a role in that mm-hmm. for you over the last few years.
I mean, a critical part of my background, Paolo now loves the story, makes me tell it. I only started telling it this year. But I think, like, something foundational for me is, so I'm Danish. I was born in Denmark. My mom's Danish. My dad's American. And the story goes, and it's, you know, a bit of a myth and possibly disputed at times, but I choose to believe it, is so my mother's grandfather was, in fact, the prime minister of Denmark, and he brought democratic socialism to Denmark. And when the Nazis invaded Denmark, the story goes that it was my great-grandfather's idea for the king to wear a star and to tell the police force to wear a Jewish star. And then what ended up happening is most of the population put on a Jewish star, and it was impossible for the Nazis to tell who was who. And in my mind, that's such a great act of, it's creative resistance. It is an act of solidarity. And that's always a story that's stuck with me. And then my father initially was at the Justice Department during the Voting Rights Act and spent a lot of time in the South, making sure people could vote. So that's just sort of where I come from.
Right, it runs through your blood.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the women's rights and justice stuff, you know, I've always been more interested in intersectional feminism. And, you know, I went to Mills College. I came up in San Francisco during the tail end of the AIDS crisis and had a lot of friends die, and ACT UP was a big part of, you know, my late teens and early 20s. So, you know, I guess coming from that background, I naively assumed we were further along as far as, like, the intersectional component of feminism. And it really wasn't until organizing the Women's March that I truly felt like, oh, this is what intersectionality is. You know, I've been pushing and trying, but I don't think we're as far along as we think we are. And certainly, you know, the way that white women continue to vote proves that. And, you know, it's just a whole confluence of things that led me to this.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller, talking with two of the Women's March organizers, Paola Mendoza and Sarah Sophie Flicker. Remember those moments before the election when we were convinced the United States was about to elect our first female president? And then the ground shifted beneath, everyone? It was still an historic moment for women. Just not the moment that I and so many of us had anticipated. I realized then that things were going to have to get worse before they got a lot better. And getting better meant working together, raising our voices together, and rising up together. But first, how did the Women's March get off the ground? For the record, the story goes,
you know, there was Teresa Shook. She put her idea up on Facebook because she had this idea and she was angry. She was an organizer. She'd never organized before in her life. She lived in Hawaii. She puts it on Facebook. She's like, I'm going to march on Washington on January 21st. Who's with me? She goes to sleep. She wakes up. It's 10,000 people are saying she's coming. She's like, oh, shit, I don't know what I'm doing. So she connects with Bob Bland. Bob Bland then connects with a whole bunch of other women, white women. All of them are white. They're not organizers. And some of them, one of them, I don't know who, actually says, like, let's call it the Million Woman March. So that explodes on Facebook, really because of the historical problems that feminism has had with white women and women of color, in particular, black women. So that wound, and it's a generational wound, reopens. And those women, I have to say, those five women or six white women that were organizing at that time realized, oh, well, we don't have any women of color leading this with us. We need to reach out and we need to find women of color. So Vanessa Rubble was one of those women. She reaches out to Michael Skolnick. Michael Skolnick calls Linda, Tamika, and Carmen, who are the national co-chairs along with Bob Bland, and they come on board. The damage was done, right? And what we did, what I spent a lot of my time and a lot of the other women of color organizers from the Women's March spent our time on was reaching out to our communities to say, hey, yeah, they fucked up in the beginning, but now this is a different organization. It's all of us and we are leading this. And so what I said during that time is, look, we don't have one woman of color at the table. We don't have two. We actually have like eight women of color leading this thing. Like, we are at the table creating the vision, the policy, the unity principles, what this is going to be. If we don't show up now, then when are we going to show up? And the reality is that most women that showed up at the Women's March, at the March on Washington, were white. Like, that's the reality. But we had a lot of women of color, and we presented an intersectional movement, and we did it in a way in which, for the first time on a main stage, was happening in the United States. We did not come up with that concept. Kimberly Crenshaw did in the 80s. But nonetheless, we said, okay, here's this idea, America. Run with it. And they have, and they did. And people are fumbling through it and learning and trying to figure it out. But I don't think that you can say that this movement is a white woman movement, because the most marginalized voices have been at the leadership from the beginning.
So thinking about the role of art again in bringing more people into the movement and more women of color into the movement, did art play a role in doing that as well as making sure that, you know, the women who were actually organizing it were diverse?
Yeah, art played a huge role in the organization of the Women's March. And, you know, we ended up with, you know, over 150 you know, really well-respected, well-known artists who we leaned on very heavily to lead the charge on this stuff, you know, because we were getting so much pushback. But, you know, when America Ferrera or Yara Shahidi or Tracy Ellis Ross posts about their support of the Women's March, suddenly, you know, a whole new audience has opened up to us. We Paola can speak more to this, but we partnered with an organization called Amplifier, and all the most iconic artwork that, you know, is now so, you know, visually, like, you're like, oh, it's a women's march, you know, oh, that's the resistance. That all came out of our partnership with Amplifier, who we continue to work with. You know, our consideration for who was going to be on the stage, which Paola led, was incredibly intentional. And, you know, the collaboration that we had with artists and, you know, the work we did on social media and the work that we did in our messaging, I would say were, you know, a big part of the success.
And I would just say, so we had incredible honorary co-chairs that were part of the Women's March. Gloria Steinem was one, Dolores Huerta was another, Angela Davis, LaDonna Harris. And then we had Mr. Harry Belafonte was also one of our honorary co-chairs. And we organized out of his offices. That was Women's March headquarters. He lent us his offices, which was incredible. And one night, it was in December and it was very cold because I remember very clearly. It was late night. Mr. B, as we like to call him, Mr. B showed up at the office as a surprise. And Mr. B, at that time, he was 89, 90 years old. He had recently had a stroke. So he came in with his walker. So it was a big deal for him to be there. And my son happened to be there that night, too, because I hadn't seen him for a while. So we're sitting at the table, at his table in his office. My son's on his lap. Mr. B sitting there. And he is just like the most brilliant mind still. And he's telling us stories about his time while he organized the Civil Rights March, the March on Washington. And, you know, he had Bob Dylan there and Joan Baez there and Lena Horne there. Like, he got all of the artists there. That was his role, his job. And he said to us, and this is something that really has stuck with me, and he said it before, obviously, but it has been kind of our North Star, my North Star during this time. And he said, when the movement is strong, the music is strong. And we see that now where we are. Our movement is very strong. And we see how art and specifically music is being influenced by the movement. You know, again, going back to Black Lives Matter, there is no Lemonade by Beyoncé without Black Lives Matter, right? Black Lives Matter moved, inspired, and forced Beyoncé to tell that record, to tell those stories. And we can, same thing with Kendrick Lamar. Like, there is no Kendrick Lamar. He's an amazing lyricist. He's an amazing rapper. But what made him great in that moment was the movement that was happening around him. So where we are today with women, we are starting to see the influence of this new women's movement in the art that is happening and is stemming from today.
So, Paola, what's the best advice that you've ever been given about finding your voice?
The best advice, and it really, as everything kind of in my life, goes back to art and being an artist, the best art is the art that comes closest to the truth. And so I think with regards to finding my own voice, it's what is my truth? And that is a lifelong journey. And truth, my truth will also change throughout that journey. And I think it's both of those things, constantly searching for the truth and being willing to pivot when the truth turns to another direction.
Sarah Sophie,
I mean, I don't know that anyone's ever given me any great advice. I mean, I think about this.
Ellen?
Well, I mean, not specifically to that question. Yeah. You know, I'm like a white lady who has a pretty big platform. I don't know that I've ever had a problem with my voice, per se, you know, other than like the inherent, you know, men speaking over you and mansplaining and all that great stuff. You know, so for me, it's a question of like, you know, I think listening is a big part of my voice. I think like I finally come to a place with myself where, you know, we talk so much about raising our girls to be courageous, to be brave, to be fierce. And I know that I'm brave, but like, do I think I embody the things that like the quote unquote feminist movement has been pushing out? Not necessarily. What I'm really interested in is uplifting like the part of myself which I know is the strongest, which is like my vulnerability and my ability to listen and my ability to like think outside of experiences that directly affect me, my compassion, my empathy, I like the fact that I'm not like a yeller and I don't engage in fighting. I want to uplift like qualities of nurturing and caregiving. And I want to extend those qualities to my sons. And in general, I want to broaden this conversation for boys. I think we spend so much time talking about our girls and we spend no time talking about our boys. And if we're flummoxed over how this whole Me Too movement came about, let's look at our boys. Let's start talking about that. My daughter's 10. We're reading books. We have copious books about puberty and, you know, feminism and all, and websites. And I just took her to the Teen Vogue Summit. And, you know, it's a privilege that I get to take her to these things, that I'm invited to these things. There's nothing. I don't even know if my boys would be well, you know, they're young, but I don't know if where they would be welcome or where this conversation is happening for them. And, you know, part of like where this moment needs to get to is, you know, like I said earlier, I think, you know, this moment was uplifted because white women who are privileged are speaking out, and that's amazing. I think, you know, something that's been troubling to me is how there are absolutely monsters out there, and I am happy to throw them all under the bus. I am not happy to throw all men under the bus, and I want to help create a pathway and a language and a narrative where we can bring them in. So let your voice be your voice, and you don't necessarily have to be fierce or courageous or angry or brave. And sometimes those things play themselves out in more traditionally like female ways. And that's great. That's okay. I value those things. So
wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure and an honor.
Sarah Sophie Flicker and Paola Mendoza have found joy in the midst of anger, created normalcy in the most not normal of times, and worked side by side with women they may never have otherwise crossed paths with because of the resistance. 2017 was a year when many of us found our voices and started using them more. Beginning the year with the Women's March, taking a good, hard look at what roles we might each play in the system of oppression, and breaking the silence with the Me Too movement, which united women and men against those who seek to abuse their power. So if 2017 was the year we spoke up together, will 2018 be the year we rise together and create change together? Check out Paola and Sarah Sophie's book documenting the Women's March. It's called Together We Rise. Just in time for the one-year anniversary of the Women's March, it's available now. Look for the link on my website at inflectionpointradio.org. And if you're ready to break out your poster boards and pussy hats for the Women's March 2018, the main protest will take place on January 21st in Las Vegas, Nevada. The theme, Power to the Polls. Can't make it to Vegas? Check the Women's March website to see how to get involved in your state's anniversary event. I'll have a link for that, too, on the Inflection Point website. Speaking of finding our voices to tell our stories, tell me how you found your voice in 2017 and what you'll be doing with it in 2018. Leave me a note on the Inflection Point Facebook page or tweet to L.A. Schiller. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller with stories of how women rise up. That's our Inflection Point for today. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point. Your contribution keeps women's stories front and center, and you'll be rewarded with gifts like an Inflection Point mug and EO body care. It's all on our contribute page at inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. And to find out more about the guests you heard today and sign up for our email, go to inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and add us to your listening queue. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. And I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.